Marjorie Wildcraft is teaching us all how we might be able to sustain ourselves, whether that's in a utopian or a dystopian future, it doesn't really matter. We same principles are involved, whether you're farming in central Texas or in the Ozarks or out in the great Northwest. Doesn't matter. The same ideas apply, and she's done a lot of the trial and error work for us all. You can link up to her through coasttocoastam.com. And she was going through the list, the four different factors that apply to why she thinks the price of groceries are going to double this year. And that kind of gets sort of in a general conversation about what the factors are that will lead us to have a successful life in the world of self-sustenance. Except I think she was also leaving something off, and we'll get to that coming up, along with the answer to the question, finally, do you need a gun to garden in the future? Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Ponet. So Marjorie Wildcraft, I'll tell you, about 2 years ago, I was having a similar conversation. I say similar, not exactly, but I was having a conversation with a guest on Coast to Coast that was spoken in a certainty that with which I cannot go along, that he said, you know, that by the end of this year, of that year, it was 2008 or 2009, I can't remember exactly, but that the entire U.S. economy would break down, our currency would be worthless, and that we would all basically be in a survivalist mode by the end of that year, right around, you know, like 6 or 7 months after the conversation. Now, I believe that there are all sorts of factors, many of which you spoke of last hour, which I think are very important and prescient. And I think you're a prophetic voice. But I also don't know that any of us can know for absolute certain when any of these things are going to happen. And the more we talk about the certainties, very likely the more likely we are to be hoisted on our own petard on that. But in his case, in that conversation with him, I brought up the guns. And I said to him, I said, okay, well, then if you're right, then shouldn't we all be arming ourselves right now? That if we're going to start growing, say, just food in our backyards or food in our front yard, and we have to start preparing for this as a future, you know, what kind of caliber should we have? What kind of weapon should we have? Because I can't believe that in a world of haves and have-nots, that the have-nots are just going to sit by quietly and die. And he kind of shined it off, and we, you know, the conversation wasn't very fruitful, I didn't think. But that's why I was particularly attracted to your position on this, which I think is much more realistic about what might be happening. And I enjoyed your column about do you need a gun to garden? And was it like a general store or a hardware store? Where did you have that conversation with a guy who said he wasn't really planning for his farming future?
A local store in Bastrop County. It was a local merchant, and I was shocked. I was shocked, really, quite frankly. I went up and I was saying, here, you know, I make this DVD. It was right when, in the early days, when we were first starting to market the DVD, and, you know, you start in your neighborhood. And showing him the DVD and saying, it's right here, it's in Bastrop County, and, you know, you may need to grow food sometime. And he told me, quite frankly, I'm never going to need to grow food. And I said, what do you mean? Have you got that much stored up? You know, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, where do you live? You know?
Right, exactly.
And he's like, no. He pulls out a big semi-automatic, I don't know what, you know, from under the counter. He says, with this, I'm going to be able to get everything I need from people like you. And I was so shocked. I mean, because I'm not a gun person, or I've become one, but I wasn't at that time. I really couldn't even have a comeback, because I was so shocked at that. And now Texas is definitely a gun-toting, very proud about it state.
Sure. Exactly. Right.
But those kind of people are everywhere, so it's not like you can't say, well, that's just Texas.
No. And there's a difference between gun-toting and threatening to rob you, basically. That if you've got the food, he's going to come and take it from you unless you stop him. That is shocking.
But I've had that comment numerous times. In fact, I was on the air recently, Ocean City, Virginia, and the host, quite frankly, said, well, that's my plan. You know, I'm going to come rob from people like you. Thank you for growing it. That was his exact words.
Yeah. That was it.
And that's what we want. I mean, that's why I'm using Marjorie Wildcraft, because with my family last name and 2 minutes on the internet, you know where my farm is. Huge security risk. You know?
Right. Well, I think that's a really fair question. And we're, you know, I mean, you mentioned before, I mean, just to speak up for, you know, our listeners in the cities, you mentioned about having a farm and have it be near cities and what that might be like in the case of a food emergency. You don't have to live near a city to have your food supply threatened. Obviously, in a rural area, there's plenty of people who their first thought would be, I'm going to go appropriate myself some farm right now. I'm going to use the and so you went out of your way to start looking at weapons and to start planning on what that would be like for you to farm and then to also protect what you're growing and raising.
Very much so. Yeah. And actually, I've found it's kind of fun since then. I've gotten into target shooting and getting more accurate. And it's, you know, and we've taught the kids basic, you know, of course you want to teach them basic safety, you know, that kind of
right.
thing.
So sure.
We've begun to incorporate it. And actually, you know, when the Roman Empire fell, for centuries afterwards, they talked about the Pax Romana, the peace of the Roman Empire. And we live in an unbelievably peaceful time because of the strength of our government. But as that collapses and erodes, and I mean, we've already got cities now where they're saying, look, don't call 911, we're not coming. You know, as police budgets get cut and things start to happen, there's talk now of predatory, criminals out there that know that security is not what it used to be. Being responsible for our own security is an issue. We're going to need to address more and more. Quite frankly, it's not something I'm an expert in, but I'm learning. I feel that that's an important. You have to address that. I think that that's a reality that you need to look at.
No, I think that's totally fair, and I think that then the question is too is how when one is thinking of securing this this farm or ranch to raise food to to whether it's livestock or chickens and vegetables and fruit, then you also have to think in terms of protecting it, because if you really do believe it, I mean that's the next natural step. If you really think that this government is going to decay and we're going to be, and I'm not being colorful when I say, you know, if it's all going to turn into Mad Max, well, then your first step is maybe your most, you know, fatal one. If you pick some place that will make you most susceptible to somebody coming in and, you know, stealing your stuff. If there's one of you or three kids and, two spouses and whatever, and there's nine people showing up in trucks, you lose. I mean, there's no way around that.
That's true, you know, and that's one of the reasons to maybe move out to a more lightly populated area, to move out to an area or find an area where there are other people that are growing food, that you have community. Community is essential. Community is vital. You know, having your family on board, so that way it's not just two adults and four children or whatever it is, that you've got, you know, six or eight adults. And you know, you've got a group, and I think more and more we'll start to see that happen. We have nowhere near the conditions under which that's going to happen right now. The things are still, like you're saying, there's still lots of leftovers on the plate.
Right.
But that start to tighten up. If you want to go back to meat also, I would love to touch on that, because a lot of people are like, oh, I'm just going to raise it. There's a lot of vegetarians out there. Meat is such a critical, and having livestock is such a critical component to having a full and complete system. The animals, you use their feces as a part of fertility. In fact, you know, some of the rabbits and the geese and the chickens we have, of course we're getting meat and we're getting eggs and feathers and that kind of things. But more importantly, it's their excrement, their fertility. Fertility is one of the biggest keys to success in growing food, and having livestock and being involved in that whole circle is very important. I just wanted to get that one.
No, and I'll explore that. So how many, if we talked about the amount of acreage for people to be able to manage and then also be able to take advantage of, what kind of livestock do you think would be, is there a way of doing the math on that so that we could get a better idea of how much acreage you would need for livestock and or how many individual, you know, animals would one need in order to sustain a group of two or four or six?
Well, sure. Let me give you a couple of specific examples. Now, I love rabbits. Rabbits work really, really well in a lot of bioregions. If you're going somewhere where you have a very short growing season in the north, it's going to be a little bit harder. But, for example, in throughout most of the southern parts of the United States in the more milder regions, rabbits are excellent. They're herbivores, so they're going to eat your grass clippings or your landscape trimmings. They're not going to be competing with you for food, basically. They'd love your carrots, but don't let them eat them. I have an 8-cage rabbit hutch. It's 20 feet long by 2.5 feet wide. And out of that, we're getting about 80 to 90 rabbits a year. And I did the math on it recently. And for our family of four, two adults, two kids, that's about half of the protein requirements. Very small space, quiet animals. So you're not going to, if you're in an urban situation, you're not going to have city ordinances to worry about because they're not going to know about it. The other great thing I like about them is you process them as needed, so you don't need to refrigerate. We're always looking at systems of how do you do it without electricity or how do you do it without all the conveniences that we have now. So, you know, having a cow is a wonderful thing, but, you know, you butcher a cow, that's a huge amount of work, and then what do you do with all that meat? So having rabbits, you can get the equivalent amount of meat out of it in a year with the reproduction they have, and it comes in family-sized chunks. So we've also got it set up that the cage is above the ground and their pellets fall in a compost pile right underneath it. And that compost underneath is probably more important than the rabbits themselves, because we're using that to nourish the rest of the land.
And rabbits, you know, besides being, as you said, sort of prepackaged for a family size, you know, as you're saying, you did mention the pelts too that you can use for that?
We do. Yeah, you know, in our DVD, we include a whole CD-ROM full of documents, and we have a whole thing on tanning there, how to tan the pelts and use them with very, very simple chemicals that you can get. I'm looking for a system, maybe using the brains, where you can do it completely on farm with or in your yard without buying anything. And our whole systems are all geared toward that, because if you're having to go buy feed or go buy something from the store, that kind of negates the whole process. So we're always looking at how do you do this completely with nothing? You know, how do you do it completely on, how do you generate all the fertility right there in your yard? Or, you know, how can you do all these processes without, you know, having to go out and buy something every week at the feed store?
Sure. I think there are many people that I know in Minnesota that maintain year-round rabbit hutches, even with the cold weather, even such as it is. And I can think of at least two people that do that as a hobby, and they raise rabbits not as companion rabbits, but to be commercially sold and or shared.
Yeah, we love it, and one of the other things we include in there is a whole section on how to do butchering, and we kind of debated on that for a while, but I felt it was so important. The basic skills of how to butcher an animal is such a crucial thing that everybody really should know, and so we include it in there, and we do it very, very, very lovingly. And in fact, I've had quite a few vegetarians write me and say, well, they're not ready to do that yet, but they feel that it was possible after watching it. So I thought that was a tremendous accolade.
That seems impossible, to be totally honest, but I'm willing to take your word for it until I see the DVD. So to go back to that, so rabbits might provide enough, like about half of the meat protein that you might need. Let's talk about chickens.
Yeah, now, chickens are wonderful for egg production. A lot of people think, I'm going to have a flock of chickens and I'm going to eat a chicken a week. And if you're going to eat a chicken a week, that means you're going to have a flock of about, 60 chickens or so at least, because it takes time for them to raise them and reproduce. And if you're going to have that many chickens, you're going to be buying chicken feed. And again, if you're buying chicken feed, that kind of defeats the whole purpose. So chickens for eggs, though, makes a whole lot of sense. If you even just have a small backyard, you can have two or three laying hens, and they can scrounge around and find bugs or maybe eat, your scraps and really require almost no input at all and yet produce, at least a couple of eggs for you a day. So they aren't going to lay year round. Some breeds are better than others, but you'll mostly have the eggs that you need. And if you have a little more acreage, if you're doing the 2-acre type thing, having a flock of about a dozen chickens, they can pretty much fend for themselves with very little external input and produce you a fair amount of eggs. So, and that's what I'm all about, is how do you get food for nothing? High quality protein, of course, obviously. And the chickens are fabulous. So I want to shift people's thinking from eating them necessarily. Sure. We'll eat one every now and then, but really the egg production is the key there.
Well, and the just like you mentioned before about people who have never really tried eating vegetables that they've raised themselves, and just how splendid the flavor is, just how powerful the flavor can be of something that you may have been eating your whole life without realizing exactly how it was supposed to taste. The same thing's true with eggs, with organic eggs. I made a bid at a church auction on somebody that was doing egg raising, you know, chicken laying eggs in the city right here in a metropolitan area. And I got, I think I got a dozen eggs a week for 12 weeks as a result of my church bid. And I loved them. They did taste different. They were smaller, but I loved every bite a lot more than the larger, more flavorless eggs from the supermarket.
There's another key point you're talking about, too, that is a general truth, and that is the higher the quality food, your body knows the nutrition, and it's satisfied by nutrition. You don't need to eat as much if you're eating highly dense, nutritionally dense food. And that even goes up to wildcrafting, which is another thing that we talk about, is, you know, what the dandelions in your yard, you know, what are, or the oak tree in your yard that's tossing down those acorns, there may be food sources right there at your feet that you're thinking of as a nuisance. It's surprisingly, when you eat those foods, you know, we all think, oh, we're going to get a big salad bowl, but you really only need a small amount of that to really satiate you. So it definitely is a different lifestyle. And eating these higher quality foods, yeah, there's definitely much more flavor. I mean, the chicken that you buy commercially is a totally different thing from the chicken that you raise in your own backyard. A completely different thing.
Yeah. We're talking with Marjorie Wildcraft. You can link up to her through coasttocoastam.com. You can find out more about getting into self-sustaining farming. Just all of the things you would need to do, whether it's farming or whether you're going to be raising your own livestock, the real sort of breakdown on how this would work and where you would have to be and what type of arrangements you'd have to make. And that brings me back then to a conversation about the city versus the suburbs versus the exurb versus the rural area. Somebody has a nice, they might have a nice big plot. Let's give them credit. Say there's an acre of land that they live on in a suburban area. Some plots are that large. How much food could they really be growing even there in a suburban environment? How much closer could they get to a self-sustaining model if they really put their mind to it?
They could do a tremendous amount on an acre. In fact, they could become pretty close to self-reliant on an acre if, you know, say that you've only got two or three people. The key thing that takes a lot of production room is the fertility. So, you know, you can have a great big garden, and if you're not continually replenishing that with organic matter and nutrients, then you'll deplete it pretty quickly. And, about two-thirds of your energy and of your growing and of your interest and resources needs to go into generating and regenerating the material you need to keep the fertility up. So there's a lot of people, there's a family in Southern California that just, you know, really small backyard, and they're producing just a ton of food. What they're doing is they're importing the fertility, though. If you have an acre, you can certainly create a tremendous amount of the fertility right there in your backyard. And I would encourage, even if you're living in an apartment, I really encourage everybody to get started with just anything even small, because you never know where you're going to be in another year or two. And starting to develop these skills is very important. It takes a long time to learn. So starting right now, wherever you're at.
Yeah. And to make the psychological adjustment to that. So you start to feel like, hey, I can do this. And and exactly how you're going to get from point A to point B. Well, the DVD tutorial will help. You can find out more by linking up to Marjorie Wildcraft at our website. So I mentioned earlier in the hour, I thought there was something she was leaving off of the conversation about community, about self-defense, about being able to manage life in a time when there may not be the government systems, be they local or national, to help provide structure to a future. And I'll give you one other thought I think you need to throw into that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. looking at what we've got, and you don't know what you've got till it's gone, but it never hurts to be prepared for that next phase, which is what Marjorie Wildcraft is talking about. We'll continue this conversation before we get to your phone calls here coming up at the top of the hour. And there's more to be said about how these communities might look in the future. And I'll offer what I think of as being one thing that should be part of the conversation, which I haven't heard yet mentioned, and I don't see often mentioned on any of the websites that I go to that talk about this kind of thing. Also, if you're going to websites tonight, go to coasttocoastam.com. We put up a link to the conversation that we had, the Coast Insider group. We get together all the time and have a sort of a private chat. They're always fun, and they were kind enough to put up an excerpt from the one we did last Wednesday. You might enjoy that. Go take a look online, coasttocoastam.com. And back with your future, perhaps. What you need to know to be ready, perhaps, next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, you know, a couple of things I wanted to mention. I've sort of been making notes. Not that you haven't thought all of this out already, Marjorie, but they haven't come up in conversation. So I just want to make sure I brought it up as long as we're talking about our safety and our security and our prolonged happiness in the future, and how much of that can be self-sustaining. One of those things is fish. We haven't talked about that. And I know that if you're looking at doing a farm, say, in the Great Northwest or something, or areas, say, in the Ozarks, getting fish, whether it's from stocked lakes or from rivers, that is also a great way of protein. And how hard would it be to have, say, a stocked pond at your disposal?
Oh, you know, that I'm so glad you brought that up. Yeah, I would have to say that the pond we have, where we stocked it with catfish and perch, has been the easiest food source we have created. It really has been. And you just stocked them. We made sure there were enough minnows in there, left it alone, and came back and got some fish the next year and then years after. So aquaculture is absolutely, if you've got, you know, a pond or room for that, that is absolutely the easiest way to go that we've experienced. Our little pond in Texas, we have such dramatic changes in weather and climate. You know, it goes from being almost, you know, a large quarter of an acre down to almost a little puddle. We're really glad it never actually completely dried up. So it's not always as reliable as we'd like. If you're in a place where you've got some regular water that stays there, absolutely. And then even on the other range of it, we haven't done as much experimentation as I would like, but there's a whole system of barrel ponics or aquaponics, where you and people do this in 55-gallon drums, and they'll raise some fish in the drums. The fish excrement in the water is used to fertilize plants that are growing in other drums, and the plants are used to clean the water, and the water, the clean water, is sent back to the fish. One of the reasons we haven't done a lot is it involves some pumps, and it involves a little bit higher technology than I personally want to be involved with. I'm very interested in things that don't require any electricity or any moving parts at all. But the people that do barrel ponics claim some very high yields, and I know I've been working with some military families that, you know, they're only in one place for 2 years, and then they move. They're in another base, and they're wanting to get food systems up and going. And they are very successfully using these barrel ponic systems, because then they can just pack that up and move, and they don't have to have earth and ground. And yet they're still growing, you know, some of their own food supply, certainly gaining skills and gaining familiarity, and it's a system that's working for them. Fish, absolutely. There's a lot of places in where it's not going to be possible. More of your arid Southwest and some of the more arid places, water is just at such a premium, you know, you're not going to be able to have a pond. But in the places where you can, absolutely. Aquaculture is the easiest way to go by far.
And I hope there are DVDs out there, or that this is something that you address as well, on how to stock it and what's overstocking, and how to make sure that, you know, you don't that the fish you do have enough of the right, you know, temperatures and depths to be able to create more food for the future.
Absolutely, we have a whole document on that, and the vast majority of ponds are an acre or less in size. They're all small ponds. I think there's actually 1 million of them in Texas alone. And we do have documents to help you figure out what kind of fish you want to put in there and how to take care of that. But yeah, aquaculture is absolutely a big must, as well as we also have information on baroponics and how to get started with that.
Well, I like that. But now the one thing that I don't hear often mentioned, and I don't mean this as criticism, but I think it's so crucial. And yet it's spoken of almost like one isn't going to need it. And that is healthcare. And when we're looking at these self-sustaining communities in the future, somehow, and I read a lot of this material, the idea of a healthcare is sort of limited to being able to make wood splints for broken legs and or, you know, be able to provide aloe for wounds or something. And that there, I think we are, as a species, we're much more complicated than that. And I was wondering whether those considerations about long-term health care and whether or not you might have a doctor in a community or whether there would be ways for a community to get behind this is to sustaining a doctor if the doctor were willing to sustain them.
Yeah, very much. Medical is a big component. And right, you know, personally in my life, one of the things I'm doing right now is switching to things that I can use. For example, garlic. I just recently had some sinus trouble and found that eating a clove of garlic on a regular basis completely knocked out the sinus infection that I normally have with that. And I'm like, wow, what a powerful antibiotic. But
sure.
You know, during the Civil War, you know, that was a standard issue to a soldier, was a garlic and yarrow, and the yarrow is for stopping blood, and the garlic was for infection. And so learning to use those things, we regularly sponsor workshops with interesting people that have skills that are very simple. And we had one gentleman bringing up alternatives to dentists. Now, how can you brush your teeth just using sticks? How do you make your own little toothbrushes, and how do you care for your teeth? What kind of just natural herbal supplements can you use to help rebuild enamel? And another neat thing that we've been working with is how to treat infections without antibiotics. So poulticing, you know, using the local plants in your area, whether that's plantain leaf to make a poultice, or in the Southwest it would be using prickly pear leaves. Absolutely. And the time to start that is right now. Getting familiar with those treatments now and finding out how effective they are and under what situations they're effective, and transitioning your life into that right now rather than saying, oh, you know, I've got the book on it and I'll learn it later, you know.
Well, but I still think that, and I appreciate everything you said, but I know from I think that there are other models that are out there that maybe even come from antiquity, and you want to go back to the Civil War, but I think there are plenty of models for when a co-op of farmers, of people, whether they contracted with a teacher, whether they contracted with a doctor, they made a point for them to all contribute to the welfare of somebody that was going to provide a service to their families or to, you know, a group of families in exchange for, you know, the things that theoretically that doctor wouldn't have time to grow on his or her own. And I'm not necessarily talking about Dr. Quinn, medicine woman, but it's not a bad reference here. I think that is something too that communities can be thinking of if they're planning on saying getting, you know, 10 families together in the Ozarks. How might you be able to arrange to have a doctor's care available to you, and what you'd be willing to trade off as a community to get it?
Yeah, very much so, and that's an excellent model. And not only the doctors, but the herbalist, who is the person that knows the local plants. And I foresee a mixture of all sorts of things. I mean, personally, we have a small stash of antibiotics that we keep on hand. I'm not a big fan of using them, but in an emergency, I want to have that available. In addition to learning all the, you know, the herbal alternatives, and so we'd have a combination of things. I was reading recently about the collapse of the Soviet Union, and one of the surprising things was doctors began to make house calls.
Right.
After that society started to, you know, undergo the changes they did, because the medical systems, which are hugely inefficient, and it makes a lot more sense to a doctor to come out to you. And yeah, you know, will that doctor suddenly be very interested in getting a chicken from you in exchange for you, you know, treating that broken leg or that injury with the chainsaw, or, you know, the new activities you're going to be involved with are going to involve new injuries.
I just think that's something worth thinking about. I say that because we were looking at retirement models. Just, you know, we're a long way off from that, but we were looking at some of the things that are making some parts of the country more desirable than others. And when, I think it's easy sometimes when we think about a self-sustaining farm, we work on the presumption that we'll always be 100% healthy, or that by working on the farm itself will make us 100% healthy. And I'm not saying it won't improve our health, but things happen. And it's, I think that, you know, some of those highly desirable retirement areas are the ones that have healthcare systems in place and plenty of doctors that are willing to work with people as they're aging, as opposed to just, say, emergency care or something like that, where just for the active.
Yeah.
I offer that to you. Now, what about governing systems? Do you have a model where people, you know, anytime you're looking at, say, 10 families, 10 farms, and you would have, how would you begin to determine how things would be governed for a community that might be pooling some resources and expending those resources as a community pool?
You know, I think that's going to manifest differently in a lot of different regions. One thing I've been fascinated is for
I'm experiencing an audio drop again.
Uh-oh.
On this end.
Yeah.
And I don't know why.
Uh-oh.
And I'm sorry about this. This is the second time this has happened. So Marjorie, you may be talking to me right now, but I absolutely cannot hear it, and I don't know why, and there doesn't seemingly be anything I can do about it. I'm told that the last time that this happened, that everybody could hear me on the other end, but I was unable to know when I was and wasn't being heard, so I'm just going to keep talking because I'm not... And I'll tell you what, I'll stop for a second. If you want to interject something there, Marjorie, hopefully one of the tech guys will jump in and solve this problem. But I'm not even seeing anything showing up to me from your end, the audio from your end.
Hello. Hello. Can you hear me now?
So I don't know quite what to do once more.
Can you hear me now? Hello? Hello?
I'm going to check my... my text messages here. If Gina or Jesse, you want to quickly let me know what's happening, what you can hear and what you can't hear, because I'm completely in the dark again.
Okay. Well, I'm going to hang this up.
Thank you. There you go. We're back in.
Okay.
Thank you. I don't know what happened. I mean, this is the second time this has happened in the show, and there's something that's automatically switching off the connection with LA, and I don't know what it is, but it's highly frustrating. And I can't even, if I left the studio to go down the hallway to get the tech guy, by the time I got back, the problem would be where it is. So thank you. And I don't know what happened or what you said, but I'm sure it was brilliant.
Well, thank you for that confidence. You know, as things unfold, I think regionally and in different locations, they'll be different. And this is starting to get into speculation of how does it look like once our government has collapsed and how do people organize. And one thing I'm very fascinated by, I'm not a Mormon, but the Mormon Church is already superbly organized, with their people and how they contact each other and having backup food supplies and being prepared for emergencies. So it's very interesting in the West where the Mormon Church is strong. You know, undoubtedly that will be the new government that steps in. And I think in other areas where there are religious bases, in some areas it may be the military. A military base with strong leadership and commanders may end up becoming the central focus. And this is pretty far down in terms of where we've already collapsed we call it the FUSA, the former USA, and it's pretty openly acknowledged that the United States has completely dismantled. How long it'll take to get into that and what sort of groups would we have areas where there are warlords, superior force and strength, managing large groups of slave labor to grow food. That sort of thing. I'm sure there'll be a diversity of different ways. Humanity has been very creative in its history of organizing labor and resources, and I imagine all those different varieties will surface in different forms. And again, you know, I can't. You know, that's a very speculative look at the future, in how that'll unfold.
You know, I would tell you that I think it's one thing when you have homogenous groups, like say if everybody were Mormon in an area, but part of the American experiment. Part of the American experience from the very beginning has been pluralism. And I think that I would hate to think that we would lose that. I would hate to think that we would only be able to survive by being with like people. Because I think that misses kind of the point of what made us strong to begin with. And I think that I hope that there would be systems other than religious systems that would kick in and take over an area, or for that matter, warlords that would, you know, survive on a might equals right basis. I'd like to, and I don't know that I agree, by the way, the idea that this is some foregone conclusion that we're going to break down this way. But that's partly colored by the idea that I've been on a few programs with a few predictors that have all so far all been wrong. And some of those predictions were supposed to have happened a long time ago. So, I mean, I think there's hope. I really do. And I think that I'd like to think, though, that there might be other systems that we could have in place where people that are not linked for anything other than just the need to get by and to get along would be able to implement a system that had nothing to do with power or, you know, divine authority.
Well, this is certainly what I hope for. The most immediate thing that we're going to be concerned about is feeding ourselves. And the calorie will essentially be the new component of the new currency of what's important, and how things organize will organize around what is going to be the most efficient way to grow food and acquire nutrition for the populace. And personally, I would love to see things become more village or tribal oriented, with an egalitarian or natural leadership forming as it's needed. And you're right. These are scenarios for collapse that are pretty far, hopefully fairly far out there. We have a long ways to go, obviously, before such a scenario manifests. But I feel food is going to be the big crisis of sure. 2011. You know, Americans have really never ever been hungry, and there is no living memory of famine. You know, the right. Great Depression was the closest we came to it, and most of those people are gone now.
Right. No, that's a really good point. How about this, though? Why not practice if you're, say, going to be out in an area and you're thinking about doing this, even if it is not a matter of, you know, this year or next year or, you know, even 5 years from now, why not start practicing that form of government right now, working out with other neighbors and just having these, what, you know, in high school would have been what do they call those, junior governments or whatever, and just practice that. And so even if you're not actually making decisions yet, you're just getting together and having the conversations, having the models, so that when something, God forbid, should happen, you're ready to kick that in. And it's not a matter of having to learn it at a time that's already stressful with a greater loss of food production and all of the other systems that would get disrupted as well. So are you thinking about your future? What would be the one question you'd like to have answered? From Marjorie Wildcraft, you can link up to her by going to coasttocoastam.com and see the DVD. It's a tutorial on how to get a life on one's own started. I'm going to start down the hallway here and try to figure out why we keep getting this dropout on the air. And when I say dropout, by the way, I don't mean anybody. I'm not pointing the finger at anybody that didn't finish their degree. I just mean the audio dropout. And then your questions coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.